This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. It's not easy to talk about particle physics on the radio. It's about the world around us we can't see. Protons, neutrons, quarks, leptons. But some of the most exciting research today is in physics, in the search for the fundamental laws of nature. Steven Weinberg is one of the physicists in the forefront of that search. He received the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1979 and the National Medal of Science in 1991. Weinberg is also one of those rare scientists who's able to explain what he does to the rest of us. His book on the Big Bang Theory, The First 3 Minutes, was a bestseller. His new book is called Dreams of a Final Theory, The Search for the Fundamental Laws of Nature. Weinberg teaches at the University of Texas, not far from the controversial and as yet uncompleted supercollider, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. I asked Steven Weinberg what questions he's trying to answer in this search for a final theory.
Well, there's really only one question. That is, why are things the way they are? Why is the world the way it is? Of course, that question takes a vast number of forms. You can ask why grass is green, or why the sky is blue, or why the stars shine. And when you ask those many, many questions, you get answers in terms of a lot of separate sciences developed in the 18th, 19th century, like optics and chemistry. Then if, like an unpleasant child, you ask, well, why is that true? You get an answer, again, in terms of deeper truths, things we learned about in this century, the principles of quantum mechanics, the basic principles that govern the way particles like the electron and the photon and so on interact with each other. And then you can ask, why is that true? And again, the answer is simpler. At a deeper level, you get an answer in terms of a fairly coherent, unified theory called the Standard Model of Elementary Particles. And that provides an answer to almost all of these questions, at least where historical accidents don't play a role. And now, the big thing we want to answer is, why is the standard model the way it is? It's not the final answer. It has a lot of arbitrary features and some things just slapped together to make it agree with experiment. It doesn't include gravity, which is certainly a big missing element. And what we want to do now is ask, why is it, and why is our theory of gravity what it is?
Well, how do you know that there is this final theory, a theory that will explain everything? And doesn't every explanation require a further explanation and new theories?
Well, so far that's certainly been true. You could have said in the 19th century that no matter how far north you go, there's always lots of sea and ice left further to the north. And perhaps you might imagine that explorers would have concluded that they would never reach the North Pole. But, you know, they did reach the North Pole. These searches sometimes do come to an end. We don't know for sure that there's a final theory. But it's hard for me to imagine that this process by which our description of nature steadily over the years becomes simpler and more unified could go on forever. I mean, after all, how simple and unified can things get? I don't know, of course, with any confidence that the next step will take us all the way to the final theory. That would be rash to say, but I'm pretty confident that there is a final theory.
How is the work on the superconducting supercollider tied with this quest for the fundamental laws of nature?
We in elementary particle physics have made a great success in recent decades, but now we're paying the price of that success. For the last 15 years, we've been finding that experiments simply go on confirming our existing understanding, the standard model of elementary particles. In order to break out of the impasse, we have to do experiments at a higher level of energy. We know what energy has to be reached because we know from the standard model that there are going to be new phenomena discovered when we can make a trillion volts available for producing new elementary particles. In order to do that, you have to collide particles called protons together with energies of 20 trillion volts each, because much of the energy goes into just recoil of garbage inside the proton. And so we have fastened on this goal of producing collisions between protons at energies of 20 trillion volts. The supercollider is what we need to accelerate particles to those energies.
Well, let me just interrupt you here and just ask a very practical question. In talking about the supercollider, then, you're really talking about a circular track that's how many miles?
Well, that's right. It's an oval track, 54 miles around, comparable to the Washington Beltway. It's underground, deep underground in the chalk that underlays Ellis County, Texas. Inside the tunnel, there will be two tubes, vacuum tubes, in which will circulate beams of particles called protons. These protons will go round and round in the two tubes in opposite directions, millions of times around the track, being gradually accelerated to very, very close to the speed of light, until they have an energy about 20,000 times the energy of a proton just sitting at rest. That's an energy of 20 trillion volts. When they reach that energy, the beams will be steered so that they collide with each other, and at several points around the ring, there'll be very large detectors and teams of experimental physicists waiting to see what happens when the protons collide.
And what do you expect will happen?
Well, the protons will collide with each other while the experiments are running about 100 million times a second, and most of those collisions won't be interesting. There will be computers watching the output of the detectors, waiting for an occasional, perhaps one in a million, interesting event. An interesting event will be an event in which this energy of a trillion volts appears in the form of a new kind of elementary particle. There are various kinds of new particles that we've been speculating about, and we know that some of them have to exist because something has to be added to the standard model to make it make sense. And what we want to see is which of these many theoretically conjectured particles actually turns out to come out of these experiments.
Let me ask you a political question about the super collider. There's been a debate both in Congress and also within the field of science about this wrestling match, I guess, between big science and little science. Big science being projects like the superconducting super collider. Scientists slaving away in small science often feel that these big projects gobble up money that could support their projects. Where do you come down in this whole argument about the fight between big and little science?
I get a rash when people start talking about big science and little science.
Are you getting one now?
Well, I'm afraid so. Really, the big distinctions between good science and bad science. I'm not what you might call a big scientist. I work at my desk with pencil and paper. I work with a group of three or four other theoretical physicists and a number of postdocs and graduate students. We have a research contract of $100,000 or so a year. We're not anyone's definition of big science, but our work cannot proceed without the data from very large facilities like the superconducting supercollider. Some of the data we get come from laboratory tabletop experiments, experiments in nuclear beta decay and other things, but that's not enough. We need the information from these very large facilities. We're perishing from want of it. What we have to ask is not, is it a big project or a small project, but how badly do we need the information? What really bothers me is lumping the supercollider together with other projects which are even larger, like the space station, which are not scientific projects at all. Journalists love to do this, and they regularly say large science projects like the supercollider and the space station. Well, the space station may or may not be valuable depending on what sort of technology you want to learn or depending on how philosophically committed you are to getting men into space, men and women into space. But it's not a project that's going to teach us anything much about nature.
How then do you differentiate between what good and bad science is? And how do you determine whether a particular project is going to reap benefits when so much of what science is doing is asking difficult questions?
Well, we do scientific work for a number of different reasons. Some of it is done for practical, immediate purposes, finding a cure for a disease or developing a new kind of electronics for the computer industry. And that's valuable and often very exciting and certainly worth doing. Then there are other things that scientists do because the phenomena are so entrancing that they just can't resist it. For example, the study of certain kinds of phase transitions, which aren't of any great technological importance, but allow beautiful theories to be developed. That's also good science. And sometimes it turns out to have important technological applications. Then there's a third kind, this kind that's really special to elementary particle physics and I suppose to cosmology also, which I see as fulfilling a historical imperative of finding those ultimate principles that lie at the root of everything and that have no explanation in terms of deeper principles. That's one of the several motives for doing science. But I think it's a good motive. And in doing it, we have to ask, is what we're doing really directed at that goal, or are we just having fun clashing particles together? I think what we're doing is directed toward that goal. We're not studying these collisions of elementary particles because we find the particles so interesting in themselves. You know, if you've seen one proton, you've seen them all. They in themselves are not interesting the way that people are interesting. In fact, the fact that every proton is like every other proton shows how simple they are, and that simplicity is a clue that they have something to do with the laws of nature at a rather deep level.
My guest on Fresh Air today is Steven Weinberg. He's a physicist and in 1979 received the Nobel Prize for Physics. He's also the author of a new book called Dreams of a Final Theory. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is physicist Steven Weinberg. Well, let me get back to the super collider. Let's say the super collider is built and is funded and the project is underway. And after 10 years, you haven't found that collision that you're looking for. How do you know whether to keep going another 10 years? How do you know if you're on the right or wrong track?
Well, if the supercollider is funded and is finished, and then experiments are funded and performed, we're really quite confident that we will be seeing new physics at the energies that can be reached at the supercollider. That's why it was designed to have the capabilities it has. That isn't always true with new accelerators. Sometimes you build them just because you feel if you increase the energy available by a factor of 10, something new is bound to turn up. That's usually been true. But the supercollider represents one of those rare examples where we have a target in mind that we know we can reach.
How would you say that would change a everyday person's everyday life?
Well, you know, if an article appears in the Physical Review announcing the discovery of a superparticle or of a Higgs boson or of a technipion, I don't think that the public's life is going to be immediately changed. I'm proud of my field, but I'm not crazy. but I do think that discoveries at the frontiers of science have an effect not only in producing new technologies, although that's always been true in the past, but in changing our culture. You know, Isaac Newton's theory of gravity originally was understood only by a very small number of people. Voltaire had to translate Newton's ideas for the general educated public of the continent. But nevertheless, the Newtonian picture of the world, a world governed by impersonal mathematical laws, percolated through into the general consciousness. And according to the British historian Hugh Trevor Roper, it was that scientific revolution, which Newton's theory was the central element, that eventually led people in Europe and America to stop burning witches. People in general learned that we live in a world governed by understandable laws. And the process of science has all been in that direction. Darwin's theory of evolution certainly had a profound effect on the way that people look at life and the meaning of it. I think that the discovery of a final theory will be, in a way, a capstone of that historical development. It will show what kind of a world we live in, what kind of rules this world is governed by.
Where do you think scientific investigation bumps heads with religious ideas? And certainly looking at this idea of the final theory gets you into the realm of God. And you talk about Stephen Hawking. He talks about the universe in terms of the mind of God. Do you feel comfortable with that language as a physicist?
I think this is a very personal matter, and I don't have any particular credentials to talk about it, but since you've asked, I'll answer. I am bothered by Stephen Hawking or even Albert Einstein using the word God rather loosely. Einstein said that by God he didn't mean a being that cared about us, that cared about good or evil. He meant some abstract principle of order and harmony. Well, you know, you can use the word that way, but it seems to me that does violence to the meaning the word has had over the centuries. Generally speaking, people have understood by, quote, God, unquote, to mean some caring God, an interested God that cares about us and that has established standards of good or evil. You can use the word any way you like, but it seems to me that's the way to use it that makes it an interesting question. If by the word God you mean just a principle of abstract harmony and order, then why use the word, except perhaps to avoid the accusation that you have no God? With that meaning of the word God, a caring, interested God, I think you can ask, do we expect to find signs of such a God in the final laws of nature when we have the Book of Rules? And, of course, I don't know because we haven't got the final laws of nature yet, but everything I know about the historical development of science suggests to me the opposite, that as we go deeper and deeper in our understanding of nature, we find that it seems more and more cold and impersonal.
Let me ask you about discovery. And in your book, you talk about symmetry and the simplicity of an idea, talking about math and logical explanations. You also say that a theory is beautiful. I mean, that in a sense, you know you're on the right track when it feels beautiful. Can you describe what you mean by that?
It's difficult. It's difficult to say what you mean by a beautiful painting or a beautiful piece of music, and it's not easy to say what you mean by a beautiful theory, but I think it's something like the beauty of a tight, highly structured art form like a sonata or a sonnet. You know, when you hear a classical sonata, you have the feeling that no note could be changed, that you would not want to rewrite a single bar of the music. Similarly, with a poem like a sonnet that has a definite structure, you wouldn't want to change a word in a Shakespearean sonnet. Physical theories have that kind of beauty of a sonnet or a sonata. When they're beautiful, I think they're beautiful because there's nothing in them that you could imagine to be different. That's never entirely true. If that was completely true, I guess we would be at the final theory. But when you have a theory like general relativity, for example, Einstein said about it that the wonderful thing about it was that it couldn't be changed. You couldn't fool around with it and get a different theory that would make any sense at all.
Well, is that the feeling that you get, that you're on the right path? You talk about a feeling of inevitability.
That's right. We are looking for theories that give us that sense of inevitability. The Standard Model of Elementary Particles is a long step in that direction compared to the mishmash of miscellaneous facts that we physicists had to learn when I was a graduate student. But it's not all the way. There are elements in the Standard Model which are quite arbitrary, and are just put in to make the theory agree with experiment, and it's those arbitrary and hence ugly things that make us sure it's not the final answer.
You mentioned this earlier as we were talking, and my question is how, if this theory that you're looking for is in the end a simple idea, looking at nature, how could a simple idea give birth to so much complexity?
Oh, well, of course, it's hard just looking at the world as it is to imagine that there could be anything simple underlying it. But, you know, that's the way science has progressed. Newton developed a very simple theory, an inverse square law and certain equations describing motion that explained the motions of all the planets and even the fall of apples and the rise and fall of the tides here on Earth. Now we have a theory, quantum mechanics, that in principle allows us to explain all of the chemistry of all the fantastic variety of substances that can be produced in the laboratory or naturally found on Earth. Nature, beneath its apparent complexity, is really remarkably simple. It isn't a new idea. Plato, and even before Plato, Greek philosophers like Parmenides speculated that the apparent complexity of nature was just an appearance, that beneath it there was great simplicity and perfection. We're proceeding very much in that Platonic direction, finding simplicity beneath the apparent complexity of things, but not the way Plato did, not by just talking about it and thinking about it, but by thinking about it and then testing our ideas with experiments, by doing experiments which suggest new ideas. And out of this fusion of experiment and theory, which really, I think, goes back to Galileo, we find simplicity emerging.
Steven Weinberg, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Steven Weinberg is a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and the author of Dreams of a Final Theory. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.